Hello there, my name is Robin and I'm going to be hosting this radio interview with a gentleman by the name of Larry Mason, who sent me what was probably my most interesting email of the year. I'm with a group called Altruists International and we're developing an internet-based system that's decentralized and grows bottom-up to offer a grassroots alternative to the debt-based money system of the central banks. Hello, Larry, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, right. Can you explain why you sent me that email?
Well, I had written a science fiction novel, which I think has an important idea in it. And it seemed to me to help you achieve the things that you wanted to achieve with your altruist org. And that led me to send you the email in hopes that you would agree that my idea can help your ideas.
Okay, well, yes, we're making this radio program as a result. Who are you? You're not an author, are you? Can you introduce yourself?
No, in terms of occupation, I'm a computer programmer and system administrator and have been for the last 26 years. Before that, I was a college professor for 8 years teaching sociology. My education, of course, therefore, has largely been in sociology. My hobbies are coaching youth sports, reading history and science. I'm a tall, skinny guy, a great-grandfather. I'm proud of that.
Okay.
But that's enough about me because I'm not really that important.
Well, what about this book that you wrote then? If you're not an author, why did you write the book?
Well, sometimes a book is sort of imposed on you by circumstances. A long time ago when I was teaching sociology, I got this great idea. And It seemed to me that the best way to present it was in the form of a science fiction novel. So I wrote the book.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you got the idea behind the book?
Well, sure. I was teaching sociology, and I was trying to give an illustration to the class of how seemingly minor things, if you change them, have major consequences.
Yeah.
So just off the top of my head, I said, well, for example, what if we got rid of money? And, of course, the class quite rightly said, you can't do that. If you did that, you know, our economy would fall apart and so forth.
Yeah.
But being a college professor and full of myself, I naturally kept trying to think of ways to make that work.
Uh-huh.
And I got this marvelous idea.
Okay.
Well, at first, of course, it was just like an intellectual toy, and I kind of played with it. And, you know, time went by, months went by. But the more I thought about it, I kept, you know, watching evening news and seeing this horrible problem and that horrible problem and so forth. And I kept thinking, gee, you know, my idea would solve that problem.
Uh-huh.
So then I began saying, well, what do all these problems have in common? What are their common features?
Yeah.
And I discovered, hey, they do have a common element, a common thread. And my idea solves that problem because it works on that basic issue. And when I had done that, then I realized, hey, economics, sociology, anthropology, they're not paying attention to this factor.
Yep.
So accidentally, I got a great idea, and I understand now much, much better how the world works and why it works that way.
Yep.
And I felt that this is important enough to definitely put into a book so that people can try to understand why things go bad and what we can as human beings do about it. We can fix it. We can make it much, much better.
Okay, well, when did you get that idea? When did you have this experience? Did it happen suddenly?
In the spring of 1970, yes.
Ah.
And, of course, I've been thinking about it for 35 years before I wrote the book, so
right.
I put a lot of thought into it.
Yes, 35 years of thinking about something might just make a difference. Right, how long did it take you once you started to write the book?
Well, actually, it wasn't long at all. It only took me about 18 months, and that was while I was working full-time and, of course, doing my coaching activities and so forth. It just seemed like, you know, I'd, when I felt like it, I'd sit down and work on the book, and it just flowed.
Mm-hmm.
It was like I was a typist and somebody else was dictating. You know, my subconscious, apparently, it was working overtime. But perhaps it was that I only spent, you know, an hour here and there actually writing on it. And in between, when I wasn't really paying attention, my brain had been thinking about it and doing plot things and so forth, because over and over I would find myself putting things into the story and not having any idea why I did that. And then later on, you know, 5 or 6 chapters later, sure enough, that turned out to be important in making getting the plot going on and so forth.
Right. Now, can you tell us why you've decided to make this book available on the web? And what's been the general response so far from people who've read the book?
Well, everybody that said anything to me about it has been very, very positive. In fact, the reason that I first put it on the web last summer was because one of my fellow guys that works with me, I mentioned the idea or mentioned that I was writing a book about it, and he asked if he could read it. And so I put some of it on the web, and he loved it.
Yep.
Gee, wow. So I put the rest of the book on. And he's a big basketball fan. He loves the NBA, National Basketball Association. They were having the finals, and he said that he'd be watching the game and come to halftime, and he'd start reading my book, and he'd forget about watching the game. So I said,
wow.
Goodness, it's better than I thought.
That is a recommendation. Yeah.
Well, it's what pushed me over the edge to actually start, putting it out there so people could look at it and trying to get people to read it. And so far, people that like science fiction like it. It's just a regular science fiction story. And people that are interested in economic ideas, they like it for that. My wife, who was, all the dissertation in English, read it, and she liked it because it was funny. It had so many places in it that she laughed.
Yeah.
So, I was astonished. Okay. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Can you give us a short summary of the book?
Well, man comes back to the United States in the year 2028, having been away for 15 years, and things have changed. Computers everywhere, sees everything, hears everything. It just simply is ubiquitous. And he finds this a terrible threat. But for some reason, the people around him don't seem to think of it as a problem at all. There's a parallel plot which explains how this situation came about. And that is set in the years 2010 through 2013. So it's a social science fiction book of the near future, and it has a lot of the threats in it which we're currently facing today.
So do you think this is realistic? Do you think that the world really could change, or is it just a work of science fiction?
Well, right now, of course, it is a work of science fiction. And 50 years ago, this kind of change would have been impossible, because we didn't have the technology that would have made it possible. But if we do change the nature of money, and all that requires is a small change in the law, then people's situation is changed. Their context, their environment, their worldview is changed. And if you change people's worldview, they're going to act differently. And therefore, we can make a major change in the way people treat each other with this little tweak of how we deal with money.
I mean, you said that all that's needed is a little change in the law. I mean, is it as simple as that? Could lawyers one day just write something on a piece of paper, and would that really change how people behaved?
Well,
as simple as that?
They would have to do a little more than write something in a piece of paper. Obviously, there's going to have to be some hardware involved. You got the computers and so forth, and you're going to have some occupations changed. And once that's done, you don't need to do anymore. Everything else just happens. You don't need to enforce anything. You don't need to make people do anything in particular, because their context is different. Their situation is different.
Okay. Well, can you explain? I mean, the book details how the system works, and I thought it was very convincing. I mean, the fact that you have programmed computers for a few decades is quite clear in the book as an artificial intelligence student myself. So what do you think is the biggest change psychologically? How do you think people's context needs to be changed,
well,
as you put it?
The biggest change is that people begin to believe that the only way they can benefit, the only way they can gain, is by somebody else or other people gaining. That the only way they can get money is by other people benefiting. The only way they can achieve their own ends is by helping other people achieve their ends. It's that simple.
That, I think, Larry, is close to the heart of the matter, both of the money system that we're discussing and the vision of society that we're promulgating at Altruists. Can you make that a little clearer, maybe by giving an example?
In other words, if let's say that you're a greedy, selfish person, and you don't care about anybody else, but you really want money. Well, today there's all sorts of ways you can get money that will hurt other people, but you don't care, right? So you do them.
Yeah.
Now, if we change the money so that the only way you can get money is by doing something nice for someone else, by helping them, by benefiting them in some way, well, you're mean and selfish and uncaring and greedy, so you'll do those things to get the money. You don't care that it makes the other people's lives better. You don't care that it improves their standard of living. You don't care that it makes them rich, too, because you got what you wanted.
This sounds a little bit too simple. I mean, if somebody's mean and greedy and selfish,
yes,
they might not be interested in playing by the rules. They might be they're going to go out and take something. And what?
Well, if they go out and take something, remember the computers, how they watch everything, then you'll know that they took it.
Yeah.
They can't get away with it, can they?
That's all
part of the context.
So the human, the psychological context is one thing, and another context is that computers are going to look at everything and see everything, log everything.
That's going to happen anyway, isn't it? The computers are logging more and more, aren't they? They're getting faster and faster. The software is getting better. These little cameras that you can mount on the top of your computer and so forth. People have cameras in their cell phones. I mean, the computers are going to be everywhere, looking at everything, listening to everything. That's going to happen.
Well,
you can depend on it.
Yeah, I'm a citizen of the UK, a country that leads the world, unfortunately, in CCTV cameras. So the picture you paint is certainly an all too familiar one to me. Under the guise of the war on terror, this is happening in most countries around the world. They're using surveillance technology to create a kind of panopticon in which information is passed up unthinkingly to a small, hidden set of people who see their job as controlling everyone else.
Computers are going to see everything we do. They're going to hear everything we say. They're going to be able to read your mood. You know, they can tell your emotional state and so forth. And all of that's being recorded. And you know, can you imagine a government that wouldn't be as strongly motivated to use that to control people, to make sure that those of us who are in power get to stay in power? Can you imagine a business that wouldn't want to use that to squeeze more money out of everybody else? Can you picture a church that wouldn't want to make sure that people would stop sinning by being able to observe everything they did and punish them into doing the right things? I mean, it's a terrible temptation. Right now, you have to have people in little rooms watching those monitors. But what if you get to the point that the computer does the watching, and when you do something you're not supposed to do, the computer is authorized to take action against you? Picture that happening. Picture trying to organize opposition to the government. Everything you say that might be considered, you know, offensive to the government, they hear. I mean, there's no way.
Yeah. Well, this is something that on the internet, at least, there's a lot of people are realizing pretty quickly that there's things going on the governments aren't telling us. Do you see a connection with the money system? I mean,
absolutely. Let me put it this way.
Describe a different world.
Can you picture some totalitarian dictator, whoever your favorite bad guy in government has been?
Yeah.
How would he have been able to work his evil if he hadn't been able to pay people, if he hadn't been able to pay the army, if he hadn't been able to pay the secret police, if he hadn't been able to pay the prison guards? It wouldn't have worked for him. He wouldn't have had the power. So obviously, money is a necessity to oppressive government. You can't have a mean, cruel government without using money. Every time somebody wants to go to war, what's the first thing you need to get? A lot of money. You see this in the Dark Ages in Europe. You see it in the modern day. It takes a lot of money to hold a war.
Yes, that's true. I wonder, could you explain how money brings conflict within societies?
One of the aspects of the nature of money is that in order for you to get money, somebody else has to lose money. and that makes you feel like you're enemies or opponents or competitors at the very least.
Yeah.
And if you have that relationship, well, it's really hard to feel safe and secure when you're interacting with them. It's hard for you to be open and honest with them. It's hard for you to treat them as a person who is a friend. Now, people are just naturally friendly. I mean, you watch children play, yeah. and sure, they squabble, but mostly they like each other. And
yeah.
that's the natural human way to be. But the money says, no, 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 you're not friends, you're enemies, you're opponents. The only way you can win is if by making them lose. And, you know, that does vile things
yeah.
to human relations.
Yes. Yeah, I was excited to read about the new science of behavioral economics in the last few years, which looks at how people actually behave, starting from practical observations rather than looking at complex financial models, which are usually, well, almost always assume that people are completely selfish, which we know is far from the truth.
Well, now, you understand, of course, that there are a lot of people who understand what people do with money. There are,
yeah,
but they don't understand how money works. That's two different things. One thing
yes.
is what people are doing. You can see that. You can follow the transfers of money and so forth. But the other thing is the nature of money at a very basic level, how it brings about the consequences it does. That's, of course, explained in my book in some detail. But people really don't understand that. Economists have been paying attention so much to what people are doing with money that they haven't understood, as an anthropologist might, how money actually operates, how it brings about the consequences it does.
Well, as you said, the psychologists thought there was something that they didn't understand in economics and vice versa.
Exactly.
There's a powerlessness here. People don't have an overview.
And that's one of the things that my book will give a person. It's a nice overview that makes
yep.
a lot of things very, very easy to understand.
Well, now we come to the crunch issue, Larry. Something we haven't mentioned so far are the American ruling class, the 1% who have more than a third of the wealth, who control the current system. How do you think they would respond to the introduction of a new money system, such as the one you described?
Well, that depends.
Count things differently.
How they would react to a change in the money system would depend on how they expected it to affect themselves. Now, if they expected that change
yeah.
in the money system to mean that they didn't have to worry about other people taking their money away from them, that they didn't have to worry about the money losing its value, that they, instead of having people working against them in their attempts to do what they were trying to do, they now had everybody cooperating
yeah.
with them and trying to help them to get what they wanted. Well, I mean, that's just another way to get what they want, isn't it? The switch to
yeah.
the kind of money system I propose is simply going to help them achieve their ends that much quicker, much more easily, and safer. It eliminates a lot of things they have to worry about.
Okay. In the book, I enjoyed the story about how the money system first got hold through a chain of accidents. And I think, is it 2010?
2010
that
is
was
when that chain of accidents started happening, yes.
Okay. So that gives us a few years. Do you think that's a realistic prospect?
That we can bring it about in 3 years? Well, that depends on how many people read the book, and that depends on how soon the economic difficulties become so bad that people start looking around for some things to change to make things get better. If, as long as things keep wobbling along so that, you know, nobody's too worried about things, we're not going to change. We're human beings, after all.
Yeah.
But when the shoe starts to pinch, when people start running into really serious problems and they don't see any way out, then they're going to start looking around and saying, hey, we need to be able to do something about this. What can we do about it? Well, my book, my idea, my concepts tell them what we can do about it to completely eliminate a whole range of problems and to make a lot of other major problems minor problems.
Now, that's where we have to leave the interview this time. I understand that money reform may seem like a strange topic and may not be on your list of ways that we should be healing the world. But I would encourage you, whatever your area of interest, to have a think about the points that Larry makes. Money is so prevalent in the modern industrial society in particular, that it's easy to overlook its role, to see it as a neutral force and not notice how the anonymous, zero-sum, centralized nature continues to shape our lives. As Larry's book so refreshingly demonstrates, money is not a force of nature. If we want to change it, we can. As long as we have a money system that allows people to get money, either by harming others or by harming the environment, then what hope can we reasonably have for a sustainable and a peaceful way of life? Finally, for those of you who are interested to have a read of the book, I would heartily encourage it, because that's what motivated me to make this interview. So I'll give you the details again. The title is Invisible Hand, and I'm sure you can find it. It's on the internet. If you combine that with the name Larry Mason, alternatively, for a printed copy, you could go to lulu.com, and there's also the Altruists website, altruists.org, where you can download the book for free or read more about the economic or the social theory that's connected to it. I hope you have enjoyed this look at Larry's vision of how we could all enjoy a better world, and will share it with those who are closest to you. Trouble melts like lemon drops high above the chimney top. That's where you find